think we've seen from John's Gospel, Jesus has deliberately chosen the places where he has made a lot of his comments and statements, and deliberately chosen a lot of places where events have taken place. We call them miracles, these signposts that we are looking at. And even this morning, I hope you got a bit of a picture of that backdrop of the temple, the court of the women, these huge candelabra burning, and Jesus standing up and making that huge statement to those people. I am a greater light than what you see here. I'm a greater light than that light that God gave you in the wilderness. I'm a greater light for the whole world, not just this little group of people in this tiny little nation of Israel back then. He is the light to the whole world. And we're reading from John chapter 8 today. We'll be looking at a few of the passages, not every one of them, but we'll be following through Jesus as he talks to different groups of people and the things he has to say to them. And we're starting at verse 12 in John chapter 8, reading down to verse 18. When Jesus spoke again to the people, he said, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." The Pharisees challenged him, "Here you are appearing as your own witness. Your testimony is not valid." Jesus answered, "Even if I testify on my own behalf, my testimony is valid, for I know where I came from and where I'm going. You judge by human standards. I pass judgment on no one. But if I do judge, my decisions are right because I am not alone. I stand with the Father who sent me. In your law it is written that the testimony of two men is valid. I am one who testifies for myself. My other witness is the Father who sent me." The Pharisees and the scholars and the teachers of the law, they failed to grasp the scope and the vision of Jesus' mission, of the mission of Messiah when he was to come. The Messiah would come as a light to the Gentiles as well as to their own people, and they had conveniently for their own ends forgotten this. And yet the very prophets that they loved to quote, loved to teach from, were the ones who had told them this. Isaiah in particular, in chapter 49 and verse 6, says this. He says, this is God, it is too small a thing for you to be my servant to rescue the tribes of Jacob and bring back those of Israel I have kept. I will make you a light for the Gentiles, that you may bring my salvation to the ends of the earth." And then in chapter 51, he says, "Listen to me, my people, hear me, my nation. The law will go out from me. My justice will become a light for the nations. My righteousness draws speedily. My salvation is on the way, and my arm will bring justice to the nations. The islands will look to me and wait in hope for my arm." This is what they're waiting for. Here is Jesus. He is this light. And yet they failed to grasp and see that this is the truth. All of those who follow Jesus will know the very nature and glory of God. And yet they are limiting themselves so much in not listening to him and taking on board what he has to say. They will no longer walk in darkness, in confusion, in uncertainty. They'll have the light of life, Jesus calls it, the light of life. Jesus has promised that those who will commit their existence to him, those who will submit their will to his authority and his rightful claim on their lives and accept him as Lord, as we heard from here, you repent, change your thinking, those who will do that, they'll no longer walk in darkness or in ignorance under the power of Satan. And he makes that a little clear to them a little later on. But as Paul wrote to the Colossians in his powerful prayer in chapter 1, he says, "For he has rescued us from the dominion of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of his Son, whom he loves." In the very next passage in that chapter, he talks about it being the kingdom of light. He uses that term. In whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. And this is Jesus' message that unfortunately these people had failed to grasp. And in their ignorance, of course, they take offence of Jesus' statements, and they challenge him all the time. Most of the interaction between Jesus and the religious leaders in chapter 8 only highlights, I think, the yawning gap between what Jesus is saying and their lack of understanding. For all their knowledge and study of the scriptures, the Pharisees are exposed by Jesus for their lack of understanding, not even just about him personally, but about Messiah, about the coming king, the one that God will send. And Jesus' testimony further strengthens his case, because he knows the source and nature of his mission. He knows where he's come from. He knows what he is about. He is about his Father's business. Reading this dialogue between them, it's like watching a trial, isn't it? Two lawyers who stand up and bring their arguments before the judge. Yet it's so one-sided. Have you seen those programs where one lawyer takes the other one to pieces? It's just like that with Jesus and these teachers of the law. The Pharisees appear to be stumbling in their technical questions over Jesus' integrity. They think they've got him. They think they've pinned him down. But their short-sightedness is exposed in these questions and comments on Jesus' answers. You appear as your own witness. Your testimony is not valid. Where is your father? Thinking that they know that Joseph is Jesus' father, which Tony's already covered. He wasn't. And yet they pinned their hopes on this false knowledge, if you want to call it that. The misunderstanding in verse 22 of Jesus' comments, and them thinking that he's going to kill himself. They totally misunderstand what Jesus is saying, until finally they're completely cornered, they're completely baffled, and they have to ask him, "Who are you?" They have to ask him, "Who are you? Tell us exactly who you are." And this is what Jesus says to them when they ask him that in verse 25. "Who are you?" they ask. "Just what I have been claiming all along," Jesus replied. "I've much to say in judgment of you, but he who sent me is reliable, and what I've heard from him, I tell the world." They did not understand that he was telling them about his Father. So Jesus said, "When you have lifted up the Son of Man, then you will know that I am the one I claim to be, and that I do nothing on my own, but speak just what the Father has taught me. The one who sent me is with me. He has not left me alone, for I always do what pleases him." Even as he spoke, many put their faith in him. Surely here is Jesus' perfect opportunity to clearly explain who he is and why he has come into the world. But his audience is not seeking these questions, not asking these questions as a group genuinely seeking truth. But they're an angry, unbelieving, prejudiced mob seeking a little slip-up from Jesus, a little way to corner him and trap him in his words, to undermine Jesus and to strengthen their own position. And as Tony pointed out last week, their position is built on these little half-truths and little made-up facts that they have that are not quite right. So how can Jesus really respond in a way to help them to see the truth, when all they want to do is distort what he says to strengthen their own arguments? It's very hard. I'm sure you've all tried to argue with someone who's already made up their mind about something. What can you do? How do you talk to people who are in that situation? It's extremely difficult. Jesus uses some explosive sort of language, language that they would not be very happy to hear. But it will make his identity crystal clear to them. The phrase in verse 25, when he says, they say, "Who are you?" Just what I've always claimed to be. Apparently it's a very difficult phrase to translate. Variations swing from terms like, "Why should I even be speaking to you?" To, "I told you at the beginning what I am speaking now." There's a great distance between those two interpretations of what he says. But the key, of course, is in the next statement that he makes, where he follows up. and he doesn't declare something about himself as if he just thought this up out of his head right then, standing in front of them. His actions, his mission, his teaching all have their origin in his Father's will. It's not about me. This is about the one who sent me. This is about my Father. And so in doing that, he is trying to reveal to them in a way, hoping that they will understand he is Messiah. And to for them to put off all these useless bits of information that they've gathered and just listen to truth. Back in chapter 5, verse 19, Jesus said, "I tell you the truth, the Son can do nothing by himself. He can only do what he sees the Father doing, because whatever the Father does, the Son also does." He tells them this in the hope that they will see who it is that has sent him. But his opponents will come to know who he is in a very unexpected way. "When the Son of Man is lifted up, then you will know that I am." And of course he goes on to say other things, but he uses that term. Not the first time that Jesus uses this term, "I am." But those listening to him would not have missed the significance of his use of this phrase, which will happen again in the concluding part of this chapter in a very tumultuous way. In his shameful crucifixion, they will know he is the Son of Man, the one sent by the Father. They will know he is Messiah, light of the world. But what an incredible paradox that in their attempt to get rid of Jesus, these angry people will not only discover who he is for themselves, they will play their own role in bringing God's purposes, described by the very prophets that they admire and teach about so much, to fulfilment. Jesus goes on in verse 30 to 33 of chapter 8. "Even as he spoke, many put their faith in him. To the Jews who had believed in him, Jesus said, 'If you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free.' They answered him, 'We are Abraham's descendants and have never been slaves of anyone. How can you say that we shall be set free?'" It's almost a bit of a comical comment that they make here that we'll look at in a minute. "But many who listen to him put their faith in him." But how deeply are they really committed to Jesus? Will they put aside centuries of their religious teachings, the influences of their leaders, their religious teachings, the common link that they have in their communities, their families? Will they set those things aside as they listen to what Jesus has to say? We were talking on Tuesday night. David was saying it's so difficult to set aside all those things that you've been brought up with for generations. It's so difficult to set those things aside, and yet that's what Jesus was calling them and calls us to do. I'm sure we can all recall stories from missionaries who talk about the courage of new believers in other cultures, where to acknowledge Jesus is to be cut off from community, from family, and just to be cut adrift. The courage that it takes to do that. But did these people have that in mind, or did they have something else in mind as they put their faith in him? Others had already tried to make him king on one occasion. Did these people see in Jesus somebody who could bring about a means to their own ends, a political leader who would free them from the grip of Roman rule? Did they see Jesus in that light? Jesus told his listeners that whoever followed him will never walk in darkness but will have the light of life. Now he tells them, those who appear to have put their faith in him, that if they hold to his teachings, they are really his disciples, that they will know the truth and the truth will set them free. Jesus is making it utterly clear that it will mean what it will mean to be a follower of his, a disciple. He is not seeking short-term zealots who will abandon him once they have reached their own immediate goals, once their own ideas of what they think Messiah is about have been fulfilled. They'll abandon Jesus or someone else will come up and claim to be the Christ and they'll follow that person. Jesus is making it clear that he is not looking for people to do that. He's not looking for people to boost his own army of followers, to create an army to overthrow, in a political sense, what's happening. He's not looking to do that. They must hold to his teaching. John will use another word later on in his gospel. He'll use the word abide. Abide in Jesus. Live in his word. Be at home in him. Be at home in his word, in his teaching. Let it be something that's so let it be something that is so real to you, it's just like getting up and living every day. That's what Jesus is looking for in those people who will follow him. There's so much more than learning and memorizing rules and great slabs of scripture that they're used to from their own religious leaders, and then being able to verbalize that like a parrot. The discovery of truth, the freedom of truth, is found in obeying and yielding to its author, and that of course is Jesus. He goes on, this is talking to people now, remember, this is he's talking to people who have put their faith in him, no matter how deeply it is. He's talking to those people who say they want to follow him. And we're carrying on in verse 34 to 39. Jesus replied, I tell you the truth, everyone who sins is a slave to sin. Now a slave has no permanent place in the family, but a son belongs to it forever. So if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed. I know you are Abraham's descendants, yet you are trying to kill me because you have no room for my word. I'm telling you what I have seen in my Father's presence, and you do what you have heard from your father. Abraham is our father, they answered. If you were Abraham's children, Jesus said, then you would do the things Abraham did. Now, these people seem to have had a little attack of historical amnesia. They'd forgotten that they were once slaves in Egypt, they were slaves in Babylon, and here they are now living under the rule of the Romans, hardly living in freedom. They didn't enjoy any of the freedoms that the citizens of those nations did enjoy. But Jesus is making a far more serious point, that they are forfeiting freedom of an eternal nature if they continue to reject him, continue to reject Messiah. If they continue to reject the one God has sent, who is the only way to be free from this slavery, it won't matter who they are, who their ancestors were, what religion they follow. Those things won't matter. They will suffer the eternal consequences of being slaves to sin and not sons or children of the living God. It won't matter if you are a son or a daughter of Abraham if you don't change your attitude towards sin. And Jesus is making that very clear. Just as Tony mentioned last week, the great offence that the Jews felt at his teaching that they eat his flesh and drink his blood, that offence continues today as they cling to their understanding of being descendants of Abraham. Jesus is going to attack this great pillar of their national identity and their religious belief. He's going to attack that as well, the great wrecking ball that Tony told us about. It's going to come through here, just as it did last week in their thinking about his flesh and his blood. Jesus tells them that if they were indeed Abraham's children, they would do the things that Abraham did. What did Abraham do? In the book of Genesis, that the Jews, love to cling to get proof about their ancestry and where they're from. It tells us what Abraham did. It's not a great surprise to us. In Genesis 15, verses 4 and 6, the word of the Lord came to him, to Abram. This man will not be your heir, but a son coming from your own body will be your heir. Remember, Jesus had made those promises to Abraham, and one of them was that he would be the father of a great nation, but he had no children. And God is taking him outside, took him outside and said to him, look up at the heavens and count the stars, if indeed you can count them. Then he said, so shall your offspring be. And this is what Abraham did. Abraham believed the Lord and he credited it to him as righteousness. They only have to do what Abraham did, believe Jesus. It's the crucial test that we see time after time in John's Gospel. What must we do the works of God? The work of God is to believe in the one he has sent. We'll add again to that verse that points to the purpose of John writing his Gospel in chapter 20. These things are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. That's all they had to do. But the Jews who put their faith in him are so much in the dark, they can't even recognise this truth when they hear it from Jesus himself. If they were Abraham's children, his true descendants, they would hear and follow Jesus, hold to his teaching, submit to his lordship. As it is, they're out to kill him because Abraham isn't their father. In fact, in verse 44, Jesus says, Satan is your father, and that they are in fact carrying out Satan's desires. They're not even Abraham's children. You're children of Satan. Now, that's pretty offensive. That's pretty hard. And these are the people who have put their faith in him. They're the people he's talking to now. It's pretty tough. Tough teaching. Tough to listen to. But only those who are... And you can imagine that this kind of comment from Jesus doesn't do too much to smooth the waters, to keep them calm. In fact, it prompts an angry response from them, and they accuse him of being possessed by a demon, and of course they play the old race card. You're a Samaritan. You're not even really one of us. You're one of those people that they just despise and hate. You're a Samaritan. Still clinging desperately to this thin thread of their physical relationship to Abraham, finally Jesus utterly answers their questions to his identity in a way that is totally revealing and totally offensive and blasphemous to them. And this is from verse 54 onwards. Jesus replied, "If I glorify myself, my glory means nothing. My Father, whom you claim as your God, is the one who glorifies me. Though you do not know him, I know him. If I said I did not, I would be a liar like you." I would be a liar like you. Wow. "But I do know him and keep his word. Your father Abraham rejoiced at the thought of seeing my day. He saw it and was glad." "You're not yet 50 years old," the Jews said to him, "and you have seen Abraham?" "I tell you the truth," Jesus answered, "before Abraham was born, I am." At this, they picked up stones to stone him, but Jesus hid himself, slipping away from the temple grounds. Jesus' triumphant proclamation makes abundantly clear its meaning by contrasting his own eternal existence with that of Abraham, a fragile human being who was the chosen father of Israel by God. There's no doubt about that. But he was not the one doing the choosing. He was not the creator, but he was created. And he died. He was not the life giver that Jesus is. Great man that he was, had great faith. But Jesus is telling these people, "I am the one who gave him that life." And this is too much for them. Jesus has blasphemed by using the sacred name, "I am Yahweh." It's too much. And they know in their law there is only one punishment for people who use this term. And so they bend down to pick up stones with which to stone him. At this point, Jesus slips away and he's hidden. We were having a little laugh on Tuesday. What happened? They bent down to pick up the stones and Jesus took that opportunity to run off. How did he get out? How did he get away? Where is he? We don't know. That's just what he did. But even now, Jesus will not allow the actions of others to interfere with his purposes and plans, and somehow he is hidden from the crowd who are out for his blood, and he slips from the temple only to return one other day when it is his time. when his time is fulfilled, and he will shed his blood even for these people who want to stone him today. But it's not today. And he slips away. Throughout the gospel we see only really a handful of people who see the signs, who hear Jesus' teaching, and who really understand and believe and abide in him. There's not that many of them. The rest either come along for a short time and then abandon him, or they reject him outright, calling him everything from crazy, demon-possessed, to a blasphemer. But there's one thing for sure. Jesus doesn't leave anybody in a neutral position. Jesus makes you make a decision. That's what happens when light comes into darkness. We're either drawn to that light or we scurry back into some dark corner to get away from the light. Jesus' light is life-giving light to all who believe and remain and abide and follow his teaching and hand over their lives to him. Their will is handed over to him. It's light to those people. It's life to those people. Let's encourage each other to follow the light and to never walk in darkness. Let me pray.